So hello, and welcome back to the Slightly Fox podcast, brought to you as usual nowadays from London, Dartmoor and Cambridge, though I for one am rather pining for the kitchen table in Hoxton Square and the days when we all gathered there to record the podcasts. My name is Philippa Lamb, I'm in Cambridge, Gail is down in the West Country.
Hi.
And fellow editor Hazel Wood joins us from Highbury in North London.
Hello.
Now this month, we're going back to the late 18th century to talk about a fascinating pair of siblings, not widely read nowadays, Charles and Mary Lamb. These two lived at the heart of a literary circle, including their close friends Coleridge and Wordsworth, and they shared a home for almost all of Charles's adult life after Mary murdered their mother in a fit of mania. Now, before we get to that gripping tale, let's catch up with one of the London Foxes. She's keeping the wheels turning at Slightly Fox HQ. Anna Kirk, hello.
Hello there. Nice to be here.
Yeah, we haven't heard from you in ages.
Yes, it's actually very strange to be doing this remotely because podcast day is usually seeing you all in the office and around the table.
So how's it been going? Obviously, have you been in the office just a day a week?
Actually, more than that. Now we're kind of inching back to as many days a week as possible. So we have a bit of a rota system and there is increasingly more to keep on top of.
So you're coming up to your, well, you're almost in your busiest time of the year, aren't you?
We are. And it's actually felt like that for some time. Usually we kind of work in very clear-cut quarters. This year has felt like pre-March and then post-March, but it hasn't really stopped. Now I've had so many publications coming out. So we've had the next two Rosemary Sutcliffe Roman novels, The Lantern Bearers and Frontier Wolf, and then the autumn book Hons and Rebels by Jessica Mitford, and everything else in preparation for winter.
And not to mention Christmas.
I didn't want to say the word, but yes, indeed.
What's the rest of your day looking like?
Well, we've had quite a few bookshop orders for An Englishman's Commonplace book and just getting everything together for the winter catalogue. It's been a joy to pick out lots of books from other publishers to include in our winter catalogue to showcase our favourites, perhaps by contributors or just things that we really think complement our own publications.
And when do you publish that?
That will be going out on or around the 15th of November.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got your work cut out. It's lovely to hear your voice again, Anna. On to this month's literary discussion about Charles and Mary Lamb. Now, it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Felicity James to the podcast, author of Charles Lamb, Coleridge and Wordsworth, Reading Friendship in the 1790s, and Associate Professor of 18th and 19th Century Literature at the University of Leicester. Welcome, Felicity.
Hello.
It's lovely to have you with us. Where are you?
Well, I'm actually up in the Lake District, just on the edge of the Yorkshire Dales, actually, in Kirby Lonsdale.
Oh, so now I'm quite envious. Now, the lives of these two, they make an extraordinary tale, don't they? I mean, for people who don't already know them, Charles was born, it's 1775. It was a modest family, wasn't it? And Mary was his older sister. Can you do a bit of scene setting for us?
Yes. So Mary is the older sister by 9 years. Charles, born in 1775. And their father is a lawyer's clerk, servant, attendant for a lawyer in the Inner Temple, Samuel Salt. And that really is the sort of clue to the family fortunes and why Lamb starts to write, really. Because Samuel Salt was not only an employer, he was a real friend of the family. And he ensured that Charles was sponsored to go to Christ's Hospital, which gave him a really wonderful literary education.
And that's a boarding school rather than a hospital.
It is, yes. It's a charity for sons of gentlemen who'd fallen on hard times. Now, John Lamb didn't fully qualify, but they must have seen some promise in Charles, I think. And Samuel does what he can for the family. It is a boarding school, and pupils like Coleridge boarded there, but Lamb just went as a day pupil.
So Charles had a much better education than might have been expected for the social position he was born into.
Exactly.
And that gave him the chance to rub shoulders with people
like Coleridge, Leigh Hunt,
yeah,
and really form some lifelong friendships there.
And Mary was 9 years older, but she was his playmate, wasn't she, nonetheless? They were very close.
Really close. Now, she doesn't have the benefit of that sort of education, but nevertheless, she seems to have had access to Samuel Salt's books and to have been really encouraged to join in literary conversation. And she's a sort of playmate. She's a second mother to him, really. I'm not sure how close his relationship was with his mother, but they were certainly very bonded. There is another brother, John, who doesn't seem to have shared in that quite such a close bond.
Is it surprising that Mary was encouraged to join in with that sort of conversation at that time? I mean, girls weren't really... The education for girls was not a thing, was it?
It was patchy, I would say. If their brothers were getting an education, girls could join in alongside. And she seems also to have been left a little bit to her own devices and to have read in Samuel Salt's library, perhaps without explicit permission.
So she was clearly bright and curious herself.
Yes, and when we think about the writing of Charles Lamb, it's inextricably entwined with Mary's. Even though she doesn't publish very much under her own name, she doesn't write things so much independently, but she's very much a part of Charles's writing.
Now, I think Charles left school at, is it 14? And then he moved into a job with the British East India Company.
Yes. Now, he didn't continue into university education, perhaps because he had a stammer and he couldn't have gone into the sort of work as a curate. So while his friends like Coleridge continued on, he goes off and takes up a job in the East India House. He starts there in 1792.
But presumably he keeps in touch with his old friends, and then he's in the same position as Mary, isn't he? Really, he's kind of getting an education at second hand.
Exactly, yes. And there are these wonderful letters of the late 1790s where he describes meeting up with all his Christ Hospital friends and enjoying literary conversation in a pub called the Salutation and Cat. And they talk about drinking egg hot and smoking Orinoco tobacco and talking through all the latest literary publications. And Charles himself publishes some books of poetry around that time. And he joins in with Coleridge's publications too and puts a couple of poems in his works.
So he's making a start on a literary career in a small way. But then in 1796, he's 21 then, isn't he? A dreadful calamity happens.
Yes, he comes home from work to find that Mary, who'd been working as a dressmaker, who'd been extremely overworked and really at the end of her tether, trying to deal with two invalid parents, mother physically disabled, father seems to have been starting to decline into dementia, and she was really overworked, unable to sleep. Now, Lamb knew that his sister was becoming poorly. He tried to find a doctor before he went out for work, but he hadn't been able to. He came home from work, opened the door to this scene of absolute calamity. They'd all been getting ready for dinner when suddenly Mary had become angry with her little girl apprentice and pursued her around the room, shrieking. Her mother had tried to intervene, and Mary stabbed her through the heart with the knife that was on the table for carving the dinner. And the father was wounded by a fork she was hurling around the room. And Lamb just walks into this scene of devastation, takes charge, comforts Mary, gets the doctor, and that moment of caretaking defines the rest of his life. Mary is taken to a private asylum, but in those days, it's before the verdict of manslaughter was brought in. She's instead decreed to be suffering from lunacy, and she's sent to a private asylum, and Lamb swears to look after her and take care of her, so she avoids being imprisoned.
It's a remarkable story, isn't it? Because obviously, even a private asylum at that time would have been a very harsh environment, I imagine.
Yes. John, the other brother, says she must go to Bethlehem, to the main mental asylum.
What we know as Bedlam.
Yes. And that really would have been a very difficult fate for her. Charles Lamb says no. He will look after her. He will be bound to look after her. And he does so for the rest of his life. She's never completely well. Only a few years are completely free of illness. But she maintains quite a contented and productive life as his sort of housekeeper, looking after him and caring for him. And in return, Charles cares for her.
So what sort of life did they lead? Where were they living? How were they living?
So in the 1790s, they are pressed for money. It's quite a difficult situation. And they move around temporary lodgings in Holborn and around that area. the family's fortunes do really decline after the death of Samuel Salt, and the onus is on Charles and Mary to make a living, then simply on Charles, because Mary has to give up her work as a dressmaker. And he's working what we describe as long hours now in the East India House. It's quite stressful work, I think. It's quite difficult work. And he doesn't earn very much for quite a while. He tries to make a little bit of extra money through reviewing, through writing for newspapers. But it is quite a hand-to-mouth existence. Nevertheless, they do keep up literary acquaintances. They really enjoy going to the theatre. And gradually, as Lamb's position at the East India House improves, and as he starts to make a little bit of money through his literary endeavours, they begin to become a little bit more stable. They take lodgings back in the Inner Temple, where they live for quite a long period of their lives. Lamb says how much he likes it being like a Cambridge college. And they have wonderful Wednesday evening entertainments where people like Coleridge and William Hazlitt come and converse. And they seem to have been a real centre of sociable conversation and friendship.
I was so fascinated when I started to read about this, because I was amazed by the fact that those people you've just talked about, their circle of friends, seemed to have quite readily accepted the fact that Mary had done this terrible thing and killed her mother, but they accepted she'd been ill, and they still were happy to be in a friendly circle with her. I mean, do you find it surprising?
It is remarkable, isn't it? Even though Mary wasn't medicated, Lamb seems to have had a very enlightened attitude to her treatment. So he knows the things that keep her calm. Creative writing, for instance, he encourages her to do bits and pieces of children's writing. He knows the importance of regular sleep, of not getting too agitated or excited. And all his friends join in this quite enlightened and tolerant attitude. And she does have periods where she goes back into private asylum care. See, when he's out at work and he's worried about her safety, if she's having an episode, he wants her to be supervised. But it reminds us how little we know really about the history of how mental illness was treated.
Yes, this isn't a story we'd have expected to hear, is it, from our perceptions of how that would have been dealt with at that time? It's much more humane.
Yes, humane is such a good way to describe it. I'm so drawn to the ways in which they used reading, writing, creativity and conversation as a way to keep her stable, engaged and to participating in the world. And she did participate. She's not a silent onlooker at those conversations. She really takes a role in the literary metropolitan conversations of those times. You hear her voice. William Hazlitt's wonderful essays, for instance, on the conversation of authors. There, you hear Mary's voice.
Now, in amongst all these responsibilities and his day job, Charles is writing. What's he writing?
He starts writing poetry and joining in, almost going along with what Coleridge is doing at that time. I should also say that Lamb himself had his own struggles with mental illness and did spend a period of time in an asylum in Hoxton in the late 1790s, around the same time as his poetry is beginning to develop. After his sister's illness develops, he never again goes into a mental asylum. I think he must have realised that he couldn't afford to become ill again. And it's around that time that he starts turning away from writing the sort of poetry of sensibility, the poetry of emotion which he had been writing. He turns instead to writing novels and to writing prose.
And did he get them published? I mean, he was unknown, wasn't he, largely?
He has a little bit of success, mostly on the coattails of Coleridge, I would say. And then he begins to become friendly with Godwin. And William Godwin is at that time publishing children's books. And he encourages both Charles and Mary to write for him. And they begin to write their Tales from Shakespeare in 1807. And then there's several other jointly written books for children. Really lovely little treasures of children's writing, like Mrs. Leicester's School or Poetry for Children.
Now, for people who don't know the Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare, just give us a picture of what they are.
They're little prose adaptations of the Shakespeare plays. So it's Shakespeare retold in prose and in almost novelistic form. So they're little lively versions of selected works. Charles took the tragedies and last plays, Mary took the comedies. They are simplified, but they're not dumbed down. They are quite complex and interesting little renditions of Shakespeare, designed to involve the child's imagination in the stories. That's what I would say their real hallmark is.
I first came across those when I was a child myself. My great aunt had a big fat Victorian edition, which I think maybe was a Sunday school prize. And as you say, I mean, I was presumably exactly the audience that they were intended for. And it was my first experience of Shakespeare. They were great, because, of course, the stories are great. Yes, as you say, they weren't dumbed down and they weren't over-sentimentalised. I enjoyed them. I remember enjoying them.
And actually, interestingly, they're the first introduction of Shakespeare to China, comes through a translation of Lamb's Tales. So that is the sort of beginning of them becoming more successful authors in their own right. And then it's not until quite a bit later on that Charles Lamb really finds a way to write which really reflects himself. And that comes in the form of the essay, the familiar essay. That's a genre which has really gone out of fashion now. But that's the mode in which Charles really starts to find his voice. He starts publishing them first in Leigh Hunt's journal, The Reflector, and then most famously in a periodical called The London Magazine. And that's really where he starts to find his own style of writing. And he starts to publish these familiar essays under the pen name Eliah.
And what's he writing about, Felicity? What are these essays? I mean, would we call them think pieces now?
They're almost closer to a sort of personal blog, I would say. They're personal pieces, meditations on states of mind, on places that have been important to him, except that they're never purely autobiographical. They're sort of playfully deflected, so they're not really fully drawn from his life, but they're informed by his life. The clue is in that pen name, Eliah, because they are a lie.
Oh, it is a pun, is it? I had completely missed that. Okay. Eliah.
Well, is it? It may not be, because there's a lot of discussion about how exactly it should be pronounced.
And we'll never know, will we?
No, but that is a kind of summary of what the essays are in themselves, really. They are a kind of tease.
I read one about the house that he loved so much. Was that the house where his grandmother worked?
That's right, yes.
Very nostalgic and sort of beautiful evocation of that house.
Yes, Blakeswear in Hertfordshire. He had relations who were caretakers there. So this enormous old house that had been left to slightly decay, he and Mary had gone there as children. And it comes up in some of Mary's stories for children as well, actually.
There's also some fantasy in there as well, isn't there? That story of the discovery of crackling.
Yes.
The Chinese peasants who keep a pig who farrows, and the house burns down and the piglets are incinerated, and in going through the wreckage they discover the joys of crackling, and thereafter every time the pig has another litter of piglets, rather strangely, the house burns down again.
So dissertation on roast pig?
Yes.
is one of the famous essays, and that's a real teasing joke about Lamb's own fondness for roast pig.
And then the other one about the pleasures to be had in collecting old china, I thought was charming.
Yes. There's a real indication of Charles and Mary's own interests in old china, in old books. Detached thoughts on books and reading is something that should be read by all lovers of old paperbacks.
Strangely enough, my copy of Essays of Eliah is published just before the First World War, and I was looking at it the other day. And in amongst the pages, I discovered this tiny little piece of oval-shaped paper with a portrait on it. And on the back, it's signed as a memento of friendship. It's a portrait of Charles Lamb, I presume, imagined. And it's dated July 1917, and it's just tucked into the pages. You know, it was a rather wonderful discovery.
How lovely. I love that sense that Charles Lamb's works really do. If you go into any second-hand shop, you will find evidence of the 19th and early 20th century love of Charles and Mary Lamb. He was really a national treasure. He was adored in the later 19th century, and often given as a token of friendships.
I was sort of interested in the idea of friendship, which is so sort of central to this whole story of the lambs. Literary friendships.
Yes, exactly. Friendships through books. I think that is the way that Lamb finds some consolation and solace for the tragedy that's befallen them. He can't go on into a literary life like Coleridge and Wordsworth, his close friends, but he participates through reading and writing, and although he's separate from them in London, he keeps up this literary correspondence, and Mary is also a part of it, often writing in the same letter. You'll see they're writing together, maybe one using black ink and one using red ink. And that sense of friendship sustained across tragedy and across distance and through time is a really defining feature of the Lambs, I think.
Yes, and it seems so relevant now somehow, doesn't it?
It does.
This idea of keeping in touch through books.
Yes.
That brings me to the point I wanted to ask you about, because he sounds quite saintly, you know, the story that we've been telling so far. I think it was Coleridge described him as a gentle-hearted friend, didn't he? But he was quite irascible, wasn't he? Quite moody and a drinker, and not always in the best of moods, I mean, quite understandably, but he certainly wasn't saintly, was he?
No. And his response to Coleridge calling him gentle-hearted is perhaps the best illustration of that. He really flies off the handle at Coleridge and he says, "How dare you call me gentle-hearted? Call me drunken dog, seldom shaven, odd-eyed," because he had one blue eye and one brown eye, "anything but gentle-hearted." The image of him as saintly is quite a misrepresentation and it's promulgated in the Victorian era. But actually, he really did struggle with his own demons, and his alcoholism was one of the ways in which that it manifests itself, this intense pressure of keeping the family afloat and caring for Mary. He seems to have behaved, judging from the letters, really quite badly at times. So you'll often find an apology the morning after for his behaviour at a dinner party. "Please thank your coachman for carrying me home."
Well, who can blame him? It was a tough life. I know you think the letters are the most fascinating insight, and they are. I mean, I've been dipping into them myself. And they do give insight into exactly what you've just described. You know, he's quite shirty with his friends, isn't he? And then there's quite a lot of apologetic stuff afterwards. But they give all sorts of fascinating insights into just how poor they were. I mean, they were really struggling to feed themselves, weren't they?
Yes, at the start, they were. And then life does become more comfortable for them as he starts writing for the London Magazine, as he begins to progress up the ladder in the East India House. But at the start, there is always this anxiety, and also an anxiety about Mary's illness. And they talk often about having to move house frequently because the neighbours have complained or begun to demonise Mary. And you do really get a sense that their lives were quite difficult.
I did wonder about their parents, because there was something I read in the letters. He said a friend had sort of spent the day playing something with his father, who would otherwise have been, the impression was, getting at him. Was it a sort of happy original family, would you say?
Well, I think that things become very difficult once Samuel Salt dies and his father begins his decline into dementia, which perhaps started quite early on. So he talks about the difficulty of occupying his father. Fretful is a word that's often used, and that he's always pestering him to play cards or repeating the same questions again and again. And there is a real sense of strain. Once his father has died, things do seem to become a little bit easier. Mary can move back and live with them. And when they're that unit, Charles and Mary, they do seem to have had real moments of contentment and happiness. His relationship with his mother doesn't always seem to have been the easiest. And he also comments on the fact, "Poor Mary, my mother never understood her." So I suppose that there may well have been some tensions in the original family.
What was he doing at the East India House, Felicity? It was obviously the centre of an enormous network of trade with India.
Yes, so he was a clerk, but it's perhaps closer to what we would think of as a modern-day accountant. There's a suggestion that he may not have been entirely temperamentally suited to it. There do seem to have been several people who were interested in literature at the East India House, and he also seemed to have had quite a quite a good relationship with his colleagues and to have enjoyed working as part of a team, because there are some quite funny letters about his fellow workers, and he alternately loved and despised the office, I think, because even though he looks forward so eagerly to retirement and to being finally free of the dead wood of the desk, he doesn't last very long in his retirement. And he seems to have been really quite melancholy and found it difficult to cope without that structure of the office day.
Thinking about the letters, Felicity, I mean, they're full of domestic detail, aren't they? And frustration and love for their friends and all sorts of little details, as well as, you say, office life. Could you perhaps read us an extract so that people who haven't read them can get a sense of the sort of thing we're talking about?
Yes, the letters are really how I came to love Lamb. And I'm going to read a little bit from one of my favourite letters, where he's responding to Wordsworth. And Wordsworth has sent him a present of the second volume of Lyrical Ballads, which has just been published in late 1800, beginning of 1801. And he's such an astute reader of Wordsworth. He loves his poetry, but he also thinks about what's lacking in it. Separate from the pleasure of your company, I don't much care if I never see a mountain in my life. I've passed all my days in London until I've formed as many and intense local attachments as any of you mountaineers can have done with dead nature. The lighted shops of the Strand and Fleet Street, the innumerable trades, tradesmen and customers, coaches, wagons, playhouses, all the bustle and wickedness round about Covent Garden, the very women of the town, the watchmen, drunken scenes, rattles, life awake if you awake at all hours of the night, the crowds, the very dirt and mud, the print shops, the old bookstalls, parsons cheapening books, coffee houses, steams of soups from kitchens, the pantomimes, London itself a pantomime and a masquerade. All these things work themselves into my mind and feed me without a power of satiating me. The wonder of these sights impels me into night walks about her crowded streets, and I often shed tears in the Motley Strand from fullness of joy at so much life.
He's quite a contrarian, isn't he? Because Wordsworth's quite a big name by then, isn't he? And he and his sister Dorothy, it's all about the lakes. It's cheeky, isn't it, in a way?
Isn't it? That's what really drew me to him when I was sort of ploughing through Wordsworth in quite an earnest way. He's got quite a... have quite a hectoring tone, Wordsworth. The person who dares to say that to Wordsworth, you can really get a sense of who he was.
I mean, they're intensely urban, aren't they?
Yes.
Quite out of step with a lot of the poets and writers of their time, because it was all about rural littles, wasn't it then?
Yes, and that's what's so special about the essays as well. A strong sense of nostalgia and attachment, but located in an urban idyll rather than a Lake District one.
It was a kind of idyll, wasn't it? Sort of growing up in the temple.
Yes.
Sort of magical almost.
Yes. He often talks about it, this garden in the heart of the city, this space that's set apart from all the noise and roar. And he loves that noise, crowd and roar, but he also relishes the contrast of being able to retreat.
And how about Mary's letters? There's a lot fewer of them.
There are a lot fewer, although I'm still hoping that there may be more to be discovered out there. But yes, and she often tells Charles things to write down in the letters, or she joins in and does a postscript in his letters. But some letters which do still exist are to Sarah Stoddart, who would later go on to marry the essayist William Hazlitt, a relationship which I think the Lambs had no small part in promoting, but which wasn't an especially happy marriage. There are some wonderful letters to her. She seems to have been a really good friend, and they obviously confided details of Sarah's love affairs. And there are also some lovely domestic details about the times that Sarah comes to stay with them in London.
Have you got a bit of an extract of one of Mary's for us?
Well, here's one from 1802, where she actually has just returned from the lakes, from visiting William and Dorothy Wordsworth. And she says that she's just spent a month with them, and I ought to have picked up something worth telling you about. But actually, she can't think of anything she wants to tell Sarah about the lakes. So here she
Nothing happened, basically.
No, I can't recollect a single circumstance I think will entertain you, she says. She says, my poor head is just now full of the memory of our walks together, driving along the Strand so fast we were ashamed of showing our red faces at your friends, or bustling down Fleet Market in all its glory of a Saturday night, admiring the stale peas and cauliflowers and cheapening small bits of mutton and veal for our Sunday dinners, returning home in all haste to be scolded for not laying the cloth in time for supper, and then chidden for laughing in an unseemly manner. You can get that same sense of mischief.
She's quite forthright, isn't she?
Yes. And she actually writes quite a forthright essay on needlework, which is almost, we would say, feminist diatribe about the need for women to earn their own bread and the importance of needlework for working class women. And she calls upon middle class women not to waste their time endlessly embroidering and sewing, to give that work to somebody who needs it and to spend their time instead improving their own intellect.
Interesting. Way ahead of her time.
Yes. Quite strongly outspoken. Of course, she doesn't publish things under her own name because of the need for her not to call attention to herself. So her children's works are first of all published under Charles's name, which she's not very happy about, and then published under simply a lady.
What about their personal lives? Because Charles, he fell in love, didn't he, more than once, but he never married.
No, and I'm never quite sure how to take his love affairs. So there was one, a girl, when he went down to the country house, Blakeshire in Hertfordshire, he falls in love with a local girl there, Anne Simmons, and writes several poems to her and talks about his great disappointment that she didn't accept his proposal of marriage. And she appears in a sort of ghostly form in several of the essays as the woman he might have married. He also proposes to the actress Fanny Kelly in 1819 and seems to have been very much in love with her, yet the letter that accepts that she doesn't want to marry him seems quite full of relief, in a way.
Ah, yeah. Well, it would have been tricky, wouldn't it? I mean, he obviously was used to a lot of personal freedom, but he had Mary, didn't he? And presumably Mary would have come with.
His proposal to Fanny Kelly is quite astonishing, really. It's a proposal that she domesticate with him and Mary. It's quite clear that they come as a package.
It's not that romantic, is it? I can't see why she said no.
And I also do wonder about the intensity of his male friendships as well, with Charles Lloyd early on in the 1790s, with Coleridge too. There is a real closeness in those male friendships which perhaps couldn't have been replicated in a marriage.
Yes, and he died before Mary, didn't he? Because he was only in his 50s when he died, is that right?
He was 59, yes. And there are some very sad years after his retirement from the East India House, the longed-for retirement. And yet it's quite a miserable existence. Mary is increasingly unwell. They move out of the centre of London, which was, again, something that they longed for. And they start living in places that Mary could access care more readily. And Charles begins to drink more and more, I think. And I'm sure that's what contributed to his death at 59. But those letters of the later years, he does keep up his literary friendships. People come out to Enfield and Edmonton to visit him, and he's growing increasingly popular. He's getting a circle of admirers. And yet there's a great misery to those later letters where he does seem to be cut off from his life.
It's such a shame, isn't it? Because, as you say, his great fame came after his death.
Yes. And it's really in the later 19th century that he becomes very acclaimed, especially as details of Mary's illness gradually start to emerge. That only becomes public knowledge after her death.
And that's generally approved of. That contributes to his circle of admirers, doesn't it? The fact that he took such good care of her.
Exactly.
But he was a remarkable man, wasn't he? When you think, you know, he had a better education than one might have expected. But the things he taught himself and how he adapted to his circumstances, it's really admirable.
And such wonderful, lively prose at the heart of it. I'd advise anyone to start off with the letters because they are such immediate, such original perceptions of London and of a romantic sensibility, but they're also so funny and domestic and friendly. And then the essays, they are perhaps a little bit harder for us to get into in the modern day era, because they are often quite antique language, quite whimsical language. And yet, when you start to think of them in our sort of personal confessional mode, they become really quite moving, I think.
Yeah, I was thinking when I was reading these letters myself, I'd heard of Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare. I didn't know anything about the letters. And I do wonder if anyone is reading them nowadays. They're very hard to get hold of. I mean, Anna, did you know anything about them? Had you ever read them?
I have, but I confess it was a very long time ago. I studied William Hazlitt's and Charles Lamb's essays as part of my university degree, but not really very many of them. And interestingly, not much of Mary comes into that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's not something that immediately occurs to you when thinking of, especially just reading for pleasure. But actually, I think letters can give a huge amount of, well, entertainment, but also insight into these writers. It's a slightly different way than diaries. It's kind of how you present yourself to others and how people communicate with each other. And it gives, I don't know, I guess a more rounded perception of people. So and they're quite intimate. It's amazing to be able to actually have such a personal kind of insight into day-to-day lives.
Well, I know, because you kind of think they're going to be hard work and it's going to be quite chewy working your way through these early 19th century letters. So yeah, I hope more people will read them off the back of this.
Felicity, going to something more concrete, you have his chair, don't you? Lamb's actual chair.
Yes, that's right. So the Charles Lamb Society is a very welcoming and possibly slightly eccentric bunch. They've been going since the 1930s, which is really now, that's the kind of period of Lamb's change of fortunes, because he was so acclaimed up until the 1930s. And then the new critical tide, sort of F.R. Leavis type criticism, and he starts to fall out of fashion. But the Charles Lamb Society keep his flame alive. Every year we have a party for him, and we also have a collection of his letters and papers, which are in the Guildhall Library, and his chair, which is an office chair of the early 19th century, somewhat knocked about, but it is held by the current chair of the Charles Lamb Society, and I'm the co-chair at present, so it's residing in my dining room being climbed on by toddlers. Perhaps I shouldn't say that on air.
We're quite envious about that, Felicity.
Oh, it's lovely.
Thanks, Felicity. That was such an interesting discussion. I've learned a huge amount. Thank you very much. Now, I'm going to let you go now, because you are actually, of course, on holiday. So I think we need to let you get back to doing just that. But many thanks for being with us. We mentioned various writers and works there, and you'll find them all listed in the show notes attached to this episode. If you listen on the website, you can also find them there. That's foxedquarterly.com. Now, we will have book recommendations from everyone next, but first, a word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Now, recommended reads. Felicity, unfortunately, has had to leave us. And actually, I think Hazel's gone too. I think perhaps she's gone to answer the door. So let's kick off with Gail.
I have been reading, and I'm still reading, Hilary Mantel's The Mirror and the Light. And I have to say, I bought a copy of it when it first came out, and it's been sitting, looking at me balefully from the shelves. And it's a very long book, as people who've got a copy will know. It's yes. over 800 pages and it weighs 2 pounds and 14 ounces. So not easy to read in the bath or in bed.
No.
But I absolutely loved the first two yeah. volumes in the trilogy. And I, as a historian, I actually studied a lot of the Tudor period. And it's like sinking into another world. It's just so clever on so many levels. You know, the way in which she conjures up places and food and clothes and the rivalry at court and the politics with Europe and the domestic detail. And then, of course, you know, Cromwell himself. And, you know, we all know how this is going to end. And the remarkable thing is that she manages to keep the tension of the story up, despite the fact that you know what's going to yes. happen eventually. It's wonderful. And I'm loving every minute of it. I was very impressed by the end papers when I first opened the book. They carry this remarkable black and white photograph of Traitor's Gate with the bars of the gate above the water. And then
at the Tower of London,
bars are reflected in the water. And, you know, of course, this is where he's going to end up, rowed in a boat through Traitor's Gate and taken to the block and executed. So for anybody who is feeling a bit daunted, I do urge you to make some time and devote an hour a day to just lying on the sofa with a cushion to prop up this enormous book and just, you know, disappear into the Tudor world.
It's a good winter read.
Well worth the effort.
Anna.
Well, I'm going to recommend a novella called Ghost Wall by Sarah Moss. It came out a couple of years ago, and Sarah Moss has actually just recently published a novel, Summer Water, in August. It's a slip of a thing at about 150 pages, but there is so much in it and it really stayed with me. It's set in Northumberland, in kind of a hot, dusty, grubby summer, which I was brought up in Northumberland and those are few and far between, which kind of adds to the slightly strange kind of atmosphere to this book. So it's told in the voice of Sylvie, who's a teenage girl. Her and her parents have gone to rural Northumberland to kind of live as ancient Britons in the Iron Age.
Okay.
It's kind of near Hadrian's Wall and they're part of this. Well, there's a professor and there's students there, and the kind of the idea is to observe these ancient rituals, forage for food, camp out there.
Okay.
But her father is an obsessive amateur historian. He's a bus driver in his usual life, but has become incredibly fixated on this period of history. So he's the impetus for them going. It's a very strange mix of these ancient rituals kind of compared with the contemporary life. And, you know, the students there are all very, they're treating it as an exercise, a bit of fun, an educational kind of project. Whereas Sylvie's father is much more ideological in his approach. The whole thing has kind of got this tension that builds and builds, and it feels like it's always on the cusp of violence. And it actually opens with the prologue. It's kind of a little vignette of an Iron Age girl being sacrificed, and it's very violent. So it's kind of this parallel between the violence of Iron Age life with kind of contemporary domestic abuse. It doesn't kind of hammer you over the head with it. It's kind of this undercurrent, and it's quite sinister and it's very cleverly done. I won't spoil it, but it kind of builds and builds to this denouement. You just sit down and read it in one sitting, a short shot of shock of a book.
Thanks, Anna. That is it for this month. Thanks again to Felicity for being with us and introducing us to Charles and Mary Lamb, worthy of a whole novel of themselves, it seems to me. We'll be back on November 15th. We'll be joined by the renowned Scottish writer Jim Crumley. Visit the Slightly Fox website to subscribe to the Quarterly magazine. Treat yourself to one of their books. Foxquarterly.com is the web address. For now, though, thanks as always for listening and for joining us on this month's literary expedition off the beaten track.